This week, we'll begin discussing selections from Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving. And I thought it would be interesting to try to set up some contrast with what he says there with what we traditionally hear in Zen about the nature of love and sexuality and in the precepts. Very typically, in the traditional view, and in even contemporary teaching like that of Joko's, there's a very sharp division between the love that, or compassion that we should strive to give freely, and the love or need or desire or sexuality that we wish to receive, which is often the subject of a lot of control, if not outright prohibition. So even in Joko, she talks about love as something that expects nothing whatsoever in return. Right? That the giving is everything, but as soon as you desire or expect something back, then you're in the realm of expectation and attachment, and you're getting yourself in all sorts of trouble. So it's been very hard for us to traditionally talk about mutuality or reciprocity when it comes to love or sexuality within a practice context. By coincidence, I just received a short talk that Malcolm Martin had written about the third precept on not misusing sexuality. As you know, he's a student of mine in England who teaches as a prison chaplain. And so some of what he's written is comes out of that context. But I think what he's trying to do is start with a precept that all too often gets translated into thou shalt not, and try to use it as a way to explore more generally who we are, what we desire, and why we desire it, and where that desire is necessary and natural, and where it goes awry and gets us in trouble. So I thought I would read you his talk this morning and try to set that up as a counterpoint for discussion with the Eric Fromm material for the group. The third grave precept. I bear witness to the power of sexuality and its potential for both love and for harm in myself and in the world, and aspire to engage respectfully with an open heart in intimate relationships. This precept invites us to look exactly how far my desires are my own, and how I consciously and unconsciously hold and express my society's attitudes, and then to look at how what I actually do impacts myself and others. Traditionally, this precept was seen simply as follow the rules of the society in which you live, both laws and customs. Yet today we live in changing times. Child marriage, what we would now clearly see as rape within marriage, and rape is a means of forcing marriage on a woman, have been legal in many cultures at one time or another. When I was born, homosexuality, child abuse, and rape were all definitely illegal, but often a blind eye was turned to them, depending on who was involved. Today, being gay, bi, queer, or straight are simply seen as alternative sexual expressions, while the huge scale of unrecognized sexual abuse in the recent past is at last being discussed and more concrete measures taken to put an end to it in the present. Our gender, what we think it is to be a man or a woman, shapes the whole of our experience, including our sexuality. As much as any other aspect of us, our gender is a product of our society and of our individual experience shaped by this society. It is part of the background to our lives, always active, but never noticed until we draw attention to it. We are blind or asleep to many things that might seem clear and obvious to an outsider. The whole purpose of our practice as Buddhism is to allow us to wake up to seeing things more clearly, even if we can never see things just as they truly are. I grew up in a culture which still had very strong assumptions, often unspoken, about the different roles, desires, and capacities of men and women. Simply put, men should hold and exercise power in society, and women might share a little of that power if they were pretty enough and compliant enough, and hence childlike enough. This attitude extended to every aspect of life. When I was a teenager, it was completely normal for men to talk of women drivers as if they were hopeless children who was dangerous to put in charge of such a symbol of male virility as a motor vehicle. And of course, the car, vans, and trucks themselves are even today designed around the body of an average man. In fact, even at the level of perception, our vision itself is gendered, not through nature, but by exactly those assumptions I've been talking about. From early childhood, we learn to see any human being first as a boy or girl, man or woman. And any ambiguity or difficulty with this will be exciting, confusing, or disgusting according to the individuals and context involved. Does this seem very far away from what we think of as sexuality? To the extent that we are not aware and awake to our world as we ourselves are part of it, of the way we ourselves are gendered and experience other people as gendered, we take part as unknowingly reproducing the structural and personal misuse of sexuality in our society. Sexual desire is one of the strongest emotions we ever feel. But there are many reasons why, for most of us, it is not so much a problem talking about our desires as to actually being fully aware of them to begin with. Our society's background Christian morality is often felt simply as labeling sexual desire as bad, if not evil. Monastic Buddhism absolutely reinforces this attitude, as our desires in general are labeled as one of the three poisons, or as being in themselves the root cause of all suffering. Our reaction against these attitudes and resulting attempt to repress desire may make us believe that our sexuality is really a core part of ourselves and our identity. Any gap between the desire I actually experience and that which I rationally think I should or would like to feel hence seems to point to something felt as my darkest, innermost self, and the mark either of an inner badness I have to cover up, or a true self that requires liberating. Point of fact, neither of these is true. We normally feel our sexuality is deeply personal and unique, really mine, really part of me. Of course, Buddhism asks us to pause every time we use those words and ask, what do I mean by me and mine? Whatever we think about the contribution made by our genes, our sexual experience is shaped from birth by our environment. How our parents behave, by our school friends, the adults in our world, by film, television, and now the internet and social media. We could as well think of collective sexual fantasies, images, and phobias coming to find their home in us as we think of them as being our own individual property. They lie alongside those often unspoken assumptions I talked about at the beginning of this piece, and we may welcome them and identify with them or not. So our sexuality is one of the most obvious areas where we don't always experience ourselves as whole, as simple and uncomplicated, and where we become most aware of how we do or don't exercise control. If we are simply ourselves and undivided, there's no need to control anything. But if we feel we never experience any tension around our sexuality, then honestly, we're probably lying to ourselves. Do I feel there are desires I cannot or must not act out on? Do I feel I have to give my desires sexual expression? Do I ever act against my better judgment? How do I feel about my fantasies in relation to what I actually do or don't do? It's not a case of simply deciding how I'm going to feel and then acting accordingly. We have to admit we don't always want to want what we want, or want what we want to want. Nor do we always want what we think we should want, or are told we should want. So what would it be to become and stay self-responsible? Is it perhaps better to have nothing at all to do with sex? This is the line taken in the monastery. For many people, there may well be points in our lives where celibacy feels like the most appropriate path. But celibacy, too, has to be a way of working with our sexuality, not simply trying to ignore it. What is denied, repressed, or ignored will always find expression somewhere, and often in damaging and harmful ways. And if we aim to be entirely without desires, then we're also without pleasure, without joy, without relationship, without life itself. The feelings aroused by sex are perhaps the area where self-honesty is most difficult. It doesn't help that desire can completely blind us. The hormonal changes in our body, whenever we think about, let alone do, anything to do with sex, can easily lead to the same kind of intoxication and carelessness, heedlessness, that is the subject of the fifth precept. The merest prospect of sex can cloud our minds, and sex can be as powerful in this way as drugs or alcohol. And of course, it's not unknown for people to combine them. If desire itself can blind us, so too can hidden fears, feelings of shame, and trauma. As always, self-honesty involves owning and acknowledging the whole of our experience, including the parts we deny, try to ignore, or repress. Can I own my own misogyny, aggression, neediness? And what do I do with those feelings? If they come up during Zazen, I can sit with them, sit with my whole body and mind, experience of them, noticing my excitement or disgust, the way that feels in my muscles, in my gut. Life as it is, to borrow Joko's words, the only teacher. Such feelings are always an opportunity to learn if we don't deny, resist, or act them out. One constant theme in looking at the precepts has been seeing where we are whole and where separate. Paradoxically, it's by seeing and accepting the real separations within myself, between what I might think and what I might feel, or feel from one moment or another, that I can hold myself as whole. And conversely, by coming to see myself not as finally separate from others, that I can respect their difference, their relative separation from me, and their unique value and right to be respected in and for themselves. I don't see them as objects to gratify, I don't see them as objects to gratify myself or as extensions of myself who will naturally want what I want. We all have an absolute responsibility to recognize and accept the harm we do to others and to ourselves. So the crucial practice question for Buddhism remains around what I do. What are the consequences of my actions? When I act, can I face up to the real effects on others and on myself of what I do? The problem is that in practice, this may not always be clear to us. I've already mentioned the literal intoxication we often feel in relation to sexual desire. Our own previous experience of what is normal within our group or society may not be a reliable guide either. We talk of drug misuse, and it might be useful to think of sex misuse too, without any idea of moral judgment, but simply looking at harm done. Misusing involves harming. Anything that is likely to harm another person or ourselves, now or in the future. So if I'm chasing that hit of pleasure in this moment, or even a momentary release from some inner pain, but someone's going to suffer for it, that's misuse. Addictions, major or minor, legal or illegal, are one kind of misuse. I want pleasure now, and I don't care about the damage I'm doing to get it. Sex can obviously get to be an addiction in this sense, overriding our ability to think clearly, making us blind to consequences. And with any addictive pattern, satisfaction is always short-lived. So there's the need to repeat it again and again and again, hoping for permanent satisfaction from some pleasure, which is always going to be temporary, is a form of delusion. So we could say that anything which causes a narrowing of our vision and a blindness to where things will lead is likely to cause me harm, and so is misuse. And that blindness will make me less aware of the needs of other people, and so much more likely to cause harm to them. This can be especially true when we use sex or other sense pleasure to hide from our real problems, to mask the pain, the true causes of our dissatisfaction or happiness, unhappiness. The evolving discussions around consent are one attempt to help with this. We can now see that consent should be active and explicit, and that everyone involved has to be competent to give it, i.e. not a child, not drunk or otherwise intoxicated, but also not unduly influenced in giving consent by the imbalance of power. And this aspect gets more complicated. I'm led to thinking back to the second precept, taking things not freely given. Where there's any kind of power imbalance involved, say a film producer and an actor, or a football coach and a player, a teacher and a student, celebrity and a fan, it's hard to see how either side can give freely and on terms of equality. So maybe that's a useful guide too. As with all precepts, the point is absolutely not that we should overthink and agonize about every decision we make. It's much more about seeing how I actually do feel and behave than trying to work out what I should do. Here again, remembering the idea that the precepts are more of a description of enlightened behavior than a prescription for what one ought to do can be helpful. How can we give freely to each other and to ourselves? What happens when we don't or feel we can't? There's a fundamental paradox here that Buddhism addresses. Do I sleepwalk through my life or try to take control of it? Control has been seen as a very masculine virtue in our very gendered society. Controlling other people, controlling our environment, has been the name of the game for men. Is trying to control ourselves just more of the same? One image we use in Zen is that of the deep ditches on either side of our path, the way. If we are the helpless slave of our desires or see ourselves as vainly battling against them, that's one ditch. But the other ditch we may not even recognize because it's based on denial. It's that I, and exactly who is that, can simply choose to be the master of my desires, to be in control, to feel what I choose to feel, to ignore what I do feel. The illusion of mastery always comes at a price, and that's one that I may seem to pay entirely myself, by cutting myself off from myself and building walls against the parts of me I don't want to own. Although what makes me hard inside generally cuts me off from other people also. But the greater danger is in how that leads me to treat others, what I expect from them, and what I do, and when I do fail in this self-mastery, the consequences can be catastrophic. So we've come a long way in thinking about this precept from the obvious do or don't questions, like, is it okay to sleep around? Our thoughts and feelings around sexuality and the stories we tell ourselves and each other about it are some of the most potent we have. Interestingly, the original wording of this precept in the Pali refers to kama, which is any kind of deep enjoyment we get through the senses. It came to be seen as referring to sex as the sense pleasure, probably the more so because it was framed by celibate monks. The monastic tradition has grave concerns also about music, dancing, jewelry, all kinds of pleasures we out here in the world take for granted. I've used desire here as meaning sexual desire, but of course we desire in all these kinds of ways and many more. So we should think more widely about pleasure, the ambivalence of our feelings around it. Take the English phrases, guilty pleasures, and naughty but nice. Do we have a problem enjoying ourselves? And when might we harm ourselves or others by doing so? Last thought, the language we use is important too. Searching for sexual fulfillment sounds good. Gratifying the sexual urges sounds less so. How we talk about things makes a difference to how we see them. And this leads us on to the fourth precept, asking about our speech. And there.